Peacock Original. A quote appears, "The creation of material is the ultimate freedom, because that's creating the world I want." George Carlin. Backstage at a sold-out Mike Birbiglia show.
All right, here we go.
Mike walks up a stairwell, which leads to the wings of a stage.
We're at the Columbus Theater in Providence. Beautiful theater. Probably about 800 seats. I'm not performing here. We're not performing on the stage.
He leaves the stage.
I'm performing up there. That's where I work out new material. This is very hard to explain.
Old Man in the Pool went to Broadway.
His Broadway show, it's fantastic. The Old Man in the Pool, with an additional two-week extension of its run. Please welcome back to the show our friend Mike Birbiglia.
Super exciting. And then it ends. It's like, well, I can't tour that anymore. And so then it's like, okay, well, now what do I do?
Fans enter the theater.
This week in Providence, it's like show number one of 500 shows, or however many it takes to be the next Broadway show, comedy special.
What's the next show about? And it's like, I don't know until I figure out what I'm obsessed with.
When a comedian puts a special out into the world, they are faced with a real sense of dread that that is the last hour of jokes they're ever going to write, and they should probably move on to a different career.
Good evening, and welcome to the Strange Attic at the Columbus Theater, where Mike Birbiglia sometimes performs shows for some reason. Thanks. Thanks, Gary.
Mike steps up to a microphone on the balcony.
Here we go again. This is the beginning.
A comedian only makes it work on stage if it looks like it's the first time they're saying it. If it doesn't seem natural, the audience feels ripped off. You really have to put all this time into it to make it look like you're coming up with it off the top of your head.
I don't know why that's so funny. You think it's funny, so it'll live to see another night in the show.
I always tell the audience, in case anyone's wondering, there will be no arc.
If you feel themes, those aren't themes. It's just the same person telling the jokes.
If you notice an arc, feel free to shout it out.
You're probably thinking, how come we don't get the final product? We just get the first draft. I think Providence is a first draft town. I just feel like maybe that's who you are. That's why my family lives here.
A notebook opens. Pages have text next to rough sketches, origin stories, workshopping, finding your voice. A title appears as its letters fill with colors. Good One, a show about jokes. Mike Birbiglia, starting from scratch.
I'm going to start with a story that took place here in Rhode Island last summer. My wife and I stayed at an Airbnb, which, by the way, no breakfast. Airbnb is a wildly misleading acronym. It's like if you showed up to an AA meeting and they're like, we're live streaming. And you're like, I had heard it was sort of a private thing. And they're like, pop open a wine cooler. We're going to dish some goss.
All I'm doing right now is just throwing out jokes and seeing what sticks. If they get a big enough laugh, I'll do them, you know, next week in Washington, D.C.
That's actually what's exciting about these shows is it's an adventure.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, wonder what this will be.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Mike came upon this idea to call shows the Working It Out, so as to set expectations. You know, this isn't a fully realized show.
I come off of doing Old Man in the Pool, where it's like this fully realized production. I've been working for 4 years. So I always have this sense of, like, do they know that this is what they're getting into? This Airbnb said 5 minutes from the beach, and it wasn't. It was not 5 minutes from the beach. It was on Seaview Road. There was no Seaview. Everything was misleading.
Text. The Appreciator. Seth Meyers. Seth sits for an interview.
I've only done one special, so I'm so impressed with Mike and people like Mike who are prolific enough to churn out a bunch. And the other thing about Mike is none of his have ever seemed even a little bit rushed. You realize that he takes that idea of what a special means literally.
Articles herald Mike's comedy shows.
Obviously, he's been incredibly lucky to be gifted with things like a sleepwalking affliction, heart trouble. You know, not all of us can have this fall in our laps.
So I told my brother Joe about this. He goes, you should come over to our place. And I went over to his house, and his house is 5 minutes from the beach. And Joe and I, we work together professionally. We've worked together for 15 years. I mean, but technically, he works for me. I mean, I sign his checks. So if he's 5 minutes from the beach, I should be 5 minutes from the beach. So I started thinking I should seize his home.
Text, origin stories. At Hope Street Pizza Bar and Grill, Mike sits with Joe and their older sister, Gina.
I think people ask you a lot, how come you didn't become a stand-up?
Yeah, okay.
Because you're very funny, yes. You're a comedy writer.
Some would say more funny.
Mike's jaw drops.
Some would say
mostly,
more funny.
Mostly our mom.
Most people.
Mostly our mom. The joke Mike has made is that I'm too sensible to be a comedian. Yeah, I had a pretty serious corporate job at the time.
Yeah.
Pfizer.
Yeah.
And finally, when he said, I need your help, I was more than happy to leave that world. On occasion, I'll write a joke and give it to him, and then he'll present it, and it won't do well. But he didn't do it the way I thought he should have done it. See here?
When I was in high school, you were living in Brooklyn, and you would take me to, like, the hipper shows that had Sarah Silverman and Zach Galifianakis.
Right.
Joe took me to see Stephen Wright at the Cape Cod Melody Tent when I was, like, 16. Two of my biggest influences were Stephen Wright and Mitch Hedberg.
It's a small world, but I wouldn't want to paint it.
Stephen Wright, of course, was all these, like, one-liner, like, cerebral jokes. People are always surprised that these are the influences because they don't think of me as, like, a joke teller, and, like, Stephen Wright and Mitch Hedberg are two of the greatest joke tellers of all time.
I want to rob a bank with a BB gun. Give me all your money, or I will give you a dimple.
In terms of developing Sleepwalk With Me, my biggest influence was Richard Pryor, Live from the Sunset Strip.
How many people you ever heard of freebasing? Have you ever heard of anybody blowing up?
He just had so many moves, wildly versatile. Sometimes you don't need punchlines. Sometimes it can just be what happened.
His influences appear under a microscope.
I love jokes, and I love storytelling. So I do these shows that are solo plays that are also stand-up specials.
At a show.
I'm a very different comic than I was when I started. I was like an observational comic. And at a certain point, I started telling personal stories about my life. And it was weird. It was a hard thing to do because I was always discouraged from telling personal stories growing up. Like, my dad, my whole life, when I would tell personal stories, he'd be like, don't tell anyone. And it would be about mundane things. Like, it wasn't about creepy things. Like, I wouldn't make the soccer team. He'd be like, don't tell anyone. I was like, they're gonna know, you know, when they show up at the games and I'm not on the team and I'm crying, you know what I mean? And my daddy was a doctor, very serious person, very academic person. He always had this thing, it was like the more that you tell people about yourself, the more they can use it against you. But the upside is incredible. If you can open up to people and tell them the thing that you'd be the least likely to tell them about, how you had cancer or how you have a serious sleepwalking disorder or any of your flaws, anything that you're self-conscious about, the connection can be so deep.
When you grow up in a structured Catholic family, there is a fear of veering way off, but I do think that mom and dad were supportive of you.
More
supportive
than,
yes.
Really?
I do. I think that more than you do.
Literally, when I told dad I was doing comedy, when I was at Georgetown, I was working the door. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm working at a comedy club at the door. And he goes, comedy club, what do they do, strip? He literally.
Right, right.
You know, and it's like
right.
On Marvelous Ms. Maisel.
Right.
Like, that's the context of right. His old-time clubs.
That's right.
When I was a kid, I feel like everything in my life was me trying to express, like, writing poetry, writing essays, writing jokes, drawing, painting, writing plays.
A Kids Author of the Month Award appears.
And just, like, in every direction, people just being like, yeah, I don't think that's for you. And they didn't mean any harm by it. They just thought I was this kid who, like, trips a lot. Like, it's almost like the great metaphor for being a comedian is, like, it's the person who trips a lot and then figures out how to write about it in a funny way. When I was 20, there was blood in my pee. My dad takes me first thing in the morning to see a urologist friend of his, and the urologist asked me to take my pants down, and he's looking around. I started to chime in with my own theories because I find doctors enjoy that. I said to my urologist, I can never unsay this. I said, is it possible that the blood is from me masturbating too often? I said that out loud to my dad's friend. The best jokes are the secrets. You're telling the audience things that, like, you're not even really telling your friends. You look at the last show, it's like, Old Man Pools, I'm obsessed with age and mortality.
Right.
You look at the show before that, the new one, it's like, I'm obsessed with having a child, even though I never wanted to have a child.
Right.
The obsession thing, it's like,
totally.
People being like, what's the next show about? And it's like, I don't know.
The last show was all about death, because it's a preoccupation, and it's relatable. We're all going to die. So now I'm trying to figure out, like, okay, I'm writing this new show. It's like, well, what's after death? What's the show going to be about? What's more high stakes than death?
He shrugs. Seen through a window, the Birbiglia siblings dine at Hope Street.
One time I was in West Virginia, when I was starting out, and this guy I was opening for, he goes, oh, you live in New York City? He goes, I went there once. The only place I saw was the inside of an abortion clinic. You know, that's like a joke where I wouldn't have written that joke like 20 years ago, but I wrote down the memory. That's how he started the conversation. Now, what I should have said was nothing. What I did say was, you really got to spend a week there to get a feel for the town. You know, I'd probably swing by the Empire State Building. If it's the holiday season, I'd go to Rockefeller Center to see the tree. The abortion clinics are nice. I was one of your things.
I journal a lot, probably 3-4 times a week. And usually it's not funny as much as it's just writing down memories so that I don't forget them.
I'll walk into his dressing room when he's on this show, and there'll be a journal he's writing in, and there's another journal, almost as if he's flexing to everybody who comes in. I might fill up this first journal so fast that I need a second one.
This is a random box of journals, which is the only type of box of journals I have. A majority of it is just writing something down about how you feel, and then rereading them later and seeing if there's anything of value that's worth saying or on stage. Comedy is mean, even when it's not mean, because life is mean and painful and cruel, or at very least, the funny parts. I stand by that. Most of the time, all of us are being polite to either everyone we're encountering or some people we're encountering. And you don't have to be polite to a journal. It is the only thing that I can think of that is culturally understood that only belongs to you. This is from, I think, when Una's like 4 years old. I just got back from Brooklyn Bridge Park where 10 four-year-olds tackled me and stuffed grass into my nose and ears and yelled, beautiful. That's the kind of thing that I would write down, and it might become a joke and might not. I mean, that would basically have to be, that would be the setup for punchline tag, essentially like the structure of like everything I do. Like in a full journal like this, there might be one line that's like anything. With all of this, you're creating clay to make a sculpture. But if you didn't have clay, you couldn't make a sculpture. And so this is the dirt.
Doodles accompany Mike's special.
My whole life, my dad would be like, don't tell anyone. Like, I wouldn't make the soccer team. He'd be like, don't tell anyone. I was like, they're gonna know when I'm not on the team and I'm crying. You know what I mean?
Mike's podcast taping.
Do you get time every day to write?
God, no.
I mean, I try, but it's like, I find that the time I'm able to write most is on the subway to the Comedy Cellar. Earlier today, I showed them my journals. I've never shown anyone my journals. Anyone.
You have
ever.
A whole record called My Secret Private Journals.
I know, but I've never showed them to anybody.
He chuckles with This American Life host Ira Glass.
So the process usually is writing in my journal, and then I'll be like, okay, I'll give that a shot on stage.
And then I have one other Rhode Island story. Pedro from Petro. Which I have to read because it's brand new. 2 years ago, my wife and daughter and I rented a house here in Barrington. Everything was great until we turned the heat on, and there wasn't any. And it was Thanksgiving.
I'll bring it to like Peter and Joe, and we'll kick around analogies and tags and things like that. The Pedro from Petro story went this week from being 4 pages. To about 2.5 pages. So it went from being about a 12-minute story this week to being like a 7-minute story.
And I called the oil company. I didn't shout, but I think he could hear some angst in my voice. And to de-escalate it, he goes, "Happy Thanksgiving."
And it would probably land up being like a 5-minute story.
Which I thought was a pretty smart move on his part. Because I was forced to respond, "Happy Thanksgiving to you, too." Even though he was completely fucking me over in real time and lying to me like the pilgrims. All right, I'll keep in that line.
You could also change "Happy Thanksgiving" to "Merry Christmas."
Oh, right, just move it to Christmas. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
In a way, that's kind of better.
Well, is it less? People do run out.
Yeah, but then you lose the pilgrim's joke.
That's the
pilgrim's joke is currently the biggest hitter.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
I feel like the upsides of this week for me feel clear. There's a lot of jokes and a lot of stories that work. The downside is it's not about anything.
I remember seeing one of Mike's shows and going backstage afterwards, and this was a show that was exceptional when I saw it. I would have thought there was no work left in this show. And then you go backstage, and it does look like a detective trying to catch a serial killer in the middle of a manhunt. So many different index cards. I don't know if it made it more or less fun to realize how much work, how much structure had gone into what I'd just seen that he had made look effortless.
So this index card thing is brilliant. Like it sounds simple, but it's so brilliant. He lays the entire show down on index cards.
Comedian Hasan Minhaj.
He tells me, if I can lift up one of these index cards and the show still works.
Decent Guys on the Bus worked.
Then that joke, that story's gone.
I was on book the other night with it, and it didn't go as well.
He'll have bangers, like really great jokes.
It felt a little stodgy.
And he'll just lift it, lift it, lift it.
I think, like, long-term, Pedro from Petro, if that's going to live in the show, it's going to have something to do with taking care of my family, some kind of stakes.
I know you well enough to know you're in between, like, 5 things at all times. You're working up new material at the Cellar. You're doing the podcast, you know. And Jen has your back, and your brother has your back. But somehow, even though they have your back, you have a feeling all the time that it's all on you. That basically, if you stop working for a month, suddenly, like, several people would be unemployed, and I don't know. I can't even imagine.
My wife, she's here tonight. She's a poet. She writes under a pseudonym. It's Allen Ginsberg. And,
text. Getting personal.
And I don't know if I would have made these shows if it weren't for Jen, because she's always really loved these shows. And I think you end up just doing the thing that the person who you're in love with enjoys. Because you're like, what else am I going to do?
Mike and Jen kiss in a photo.
Actually, it was a funny moment. They interviewed Jenny earlier today.
Jen Stein.
If you talk to Mike's siblings, you talk to his parents, everyone will tell you that Joe Birbiglia is the funnier Birbiglia.
And Jen was like, I just want to set the record straight. Like, Mike's the funny one.
Aww.
I thought that was sweet.
Photos show the couple at various events.
When I met Mike, he was 25 years old. as I got to know him, he would tell me stories. And what I appreciated about it is that he was telling me all these things about him that were like a lot of red flags. It wasn't going to work if we were going to get married and I was going to stifle his ability to talk about his life.
I'm very jealous that Mike seems to have a solid understanding with his wife about what is allowed to be said on stage, whereas my wife and I are having a continuing conversation.
In Hindi, there's a saying that says, "Ghar ki baatein mat bolo." Don't say the things that you speak of at home, which is a very, like, kind of beautiful saying about the way parents and family members feel about the way comedians act on stage.
My wife has said, "I don't care how mean you make me sound, as long as you always make me right." It's diabolical.
I'm happily married, which is to say, I'm not happy. But I'm happy I'm married. Does that make sense?
There's things that we just keep for ourselves, and that's very important to me. When I was pregnant, I had a lot of issues. I was like, I really don't want you talking about this on stage, and that was really hard for him.
But, like, I wasn't happy before I, was married, and then I got married, and I'm like, that's cool. And I'm like, I'm still not happy. You know what I mean? And then we had a child, and it's like, that's great, and still not happy, you know what I mean? And
so when Mike started writing the new one about that time period, it was a little bit of floodgates opening after I had sort of kiboshed his ability to talk about our lives for a while.
Me not being happy, like, that's what was cool about me. Like, you saw my shows, right? It's very tenuous stuff I'm talking about here. It's unformed and irresponsible.
For me to have something be in a show, it has to be a story that is attached to something real. You know, tragedy plus time, I'm always trying to find that. But if it's just serious, if I'm just talking about cancer in a serious, serious way, well, that's not like what having cancer is like. Like, when you have cancer, sometimes something funny happens. That's why the story works.
There's parts of the internet where they credit me with comedy is tragedy plus time.
Really? That's a good one,
I'm
Mike.
Like, how do I fact check that one for them? That's not me. My whole comedy career is based on it.
Yeah.
But I didn't invent it.
That's really funny.
The Yellow House.
I haven't been here in 30 years.
He meets a couple.
Do you mind if I come up?
Come on.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. This is the house I grew up in Shrewsbury. Hi there. My Mike. I'm sorry to be in your home. I remember standing up on a high chair when I was probably 3-4 years old.
Right.
Trying to get attention. Falling down, landing on my head.
Oh, no.
They take me to the hospital. I end up with like 20 stitches in my hand.
Oh, my goodness.
That's where comedians come from. We fall on our head.
Text, going home.
This week, I visited Shrewsbury, my hometown. I grew up in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, yeah. I went to St. Mary's School, it's Catholic grade school from grade 1 through 8. And like the amount that you age in that span of time is profound. Like, there was this girl in my class, the nun let her ring the bell for recess. And I remember thinking, like, ah, oh, that's so cool. In like third grade, I was like, that's so cool. I hope someday I can ring the bell. And then when she was like in like ninth grade, I heard she had sex for the first time. And I was like, wow, I still haven't rung the bell. You know what I mean?
Outside of St. Mary's School.
You remember that 3-check system? If you were talking in class, you get a check, like an X mark. And I got 3 checks like so many times because I just wouldn't stop talking.
Yes.
They taught us that God was watching us at all times. And I thought, oh, I guess he's watching me masturbate. And so I tried to cheat to the camera, thinking if he happened to be looking at the monitor at that moment, he'd think, I've seen a lot of 12-year-olds masturbate, but this kid's good.
One of the misunderstood things about comedians is people always assume they're the class clown, but I don't think a majority are.
I don't ever remember thinking like, oh, he's funny, he's funny, he's funny. Looking back on it, I'm sorry, but you were not funny as a kid.
I get it, I get it.
Your brother was funny.
Yeah, Joe's very funny.
Yeah.
Joe's hilarious.
Growing up, when I would say things that were kind of seemingly off kilter to my friends, I don't think it was ever viewed as humorous. It was more viewed as just like, why are you saying this? People would be sort of confused.
With childhood friends, Matt and Mike.
This is first grade.
This is first grade.
Yeah.
I mean, I have this now. If I say a thing that I'm thinking, it's usually not very well received.
My sister Gina and Patty, they were like teacher's assistants. And when they walked in, they saw me just being screamed at, like a teacher, like in my face. And Gina went home and said to my mom, like Mike's like pretty bad kid. Like he gets in trouble a lot.
There's one kid who used to pick on you in this class.
Oh yeah. There was one time this guy was pushing me on the hill down here, and then like Michael like attacked him. You like slid tackled him or something.
Is that like hard to think about? It's hard for me to think about. It's always hard to know, like, as a friend in that situation, right? Like,
yes.
How do you step in?
Yeah. When I was in ninth grade, I went to this all boys Catholic school, St. John's, there you are. Joey Grigioni was from Worcester. He loved to fight. One day I'm walking down the hill, and I feel on the back of my head what seems like a rock on my head. Turns out it was a fist. I forgot to mention Joey Grigioni has rock-like fists. And next thing I know, I'm just on the ground, and I'm just getting pounded in the back of my head. I didn't even run away at first, you know? Like, it took me a few seconds to just eventually be like, I guess I should leave here, you know what I mean? Like, this conversation is going terribly. It's only now at age 44 that any of this is funny at all.
Mike's mouth hangs open as he smiles. At the school, Mike and his friends stroll out of their childhood classroom.
And then I just threw in the towel. I go, you know, I'm just going to leave this school. And what was remarkable is that no one tried to talk me out of it. Not a single grown-up in my life. Not my teachers, my parents, not my guidance counselor. Nobody said, stick with it. Don't let them get the best of you. They knew that they had gotten the best of me. Like, the best of me is gone. So at the end of the year, I transfer schools. And the first few weeks of school, you're getting to know people. I say, where are you from? What was your last school like? And I decided to leave out the fact that I had been beat up mercilessly in my previous school. And you know what? They never found out. Because that's what they don't teach you in those after-school specials. Running away works.
Subtitles. It is interesting. In the context of Don't Tell Anyone, the bullying story, it essentially ends with you not telling anyone.
Who am I not telling in the bullying story?
You go to your new high school and you don't tell anyone.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, it didn't occur to me.
And that's the show. Thanks a lot for coming. This has been the first week of the next show. So I was just happy that the running away works. I got off the page.
I really like that line of like, that's what they don't teach you in the after school specials. It's like running away works.
Yeah, running away works. I think for DC, I'll try to memorize it. Also, like, just adding the context of, like, being like, I'm 44 now, and so it's funny. Mm-hmm. It's funnier now than it was then.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of gives the audience a pass to laugh. Great job this week, Gary. It's our first week.
Mike's assistant, Gary Simons, helps Mike brainstorm. Mike and his friends leave the school. Then he leaves the theater at night. The marquee reads, Mike Birbiglia, Working It Out, Sold Out. Text appears as a plane flies over the Lincoln Memorial, Washington, D.C. A sold-out sign for Mike's show sits outside the Improv Comedy Club.
This week, I'm performing in Washington, D.C. In Providence, I was just throwing out jokes, seeing what sticks. This week, trying to put together runs of jokes into what might be stories.
Text, finding your voice.
growing up, my dad would be like, hush, don't tell anyone.
In a year or two, those stories might become a show.
When she was in ninth grade, I heard she had sex for the first time. And I was like, wow, I still haven't rung the bell.
It's nice to be in D.C. The first time I did stand up, I won a contest at Georgetown called The Funniest Person on Campus. It was wild. It was hosted by Victoria Jackson from Saturday Night Live. I think it was probably the first celebrity I ever met in my whole life. I couldn't believe that she was at my college.
Text appears over a towering building, Gaston Hall, Georgetown Campus, Washington, D.C. Religious paintings and stained glass decorate an old auditorium.
The idea that I would just be performing in a 600-seat theater was just shocking. Like, I think maybe it was a standing ovation. Like, it was, like, pretty big. Funniest Person on Campus contest was when I met Nick Kroll, because he entered also. It was a really fluky thing that a bunch of comedians came from this school, because it's, like, not a funny school. It's just a very serious place. I never even clocked, really, the idea that I was doing comedy in this very, like, almost, like, religious hall. I auditioned for the improv group, and I got in. It was a long shot. Like, I think there were like 50 or 100 people auditioned. And then all of a sudden, it was friends with these 10 hilarious people who were funnier than anyone I had met in my whole life. And I was like, oh, okay. I guess these people exist. And it was very eye-opening. It made me feel a certain sense of hope. They're like, I found my people, and like that what I thought was funny about me, they thought was funny about me. And that was like a huge breakthrough in my life.
He sits on a staircase to the balcony. The lights switch off in the auditorium.
Victoria Jackson said to me, you're going to be a comedian. She had a very high voice. I actually did think, like, maybe she's right.
I got $200 and the chance to perform at the Washington, D.C. Improv, which is, like, not only best comedy club in Washington, top five, top 10 comedy clubs in the country.
At night at the Improv, guests sip on martinis. On a screen behind the stage, ads pass for upcoming shows featuring Roy Woods Jr. and Doug Benson. Mike goes through his cue cards backstage. A framed photo of one of Mike's shows hangs on the wall.
I want you to get your hands together right now for Mike Birbiglia. Woo!
Thanks, Garrett. Appreciate it. Various times, everybody.
I went and I opened for Dave Chappelle.
Nice to see everybody.
I said, can I perform here again? I thought to myself, I just need stage time. And they said, we don't need that, but we need someone to work the door. So I go, I'll do that.
I worked here at the door. So you see people down here. The worst was you have to sometimes see people behind these poles. For example, like you have those seats behind the poles. Right, no, and I'm sorry. I would bring, you know, people to, with the menus, and then I would jog away.
As an aspiring comic, you get to watch a lot of shows for free. I was able to watch, like, George Lopez and Mitch Hedberg and Louis Black and all these people who,
yeah,
like, I would have loved to have seen, but I couldn't afford it.
Started off here when I was 19, and I was like an observational comic. Like, the kinds of jokes that I would say would be like, I would hate to be a stick insect, you know, because all the other insects were always bumping into you. And that's the whole joke. That would be my act.
The first time I told a joke that worked, I said, my girlfriend is getting to the age where she's thinking about having kids, which is exciting because we're going to have to break up. And I said, I don't want to have kids until I'm sure nothing else good can happen in my life. It was like an inflection point, not because the joke is so great, but because it was the moment where I realized that telling an honest truth about how I felt connected with a group of people in a room. Like, there was a feeling of, like, oh, they get me and I get them. In a way that, like, an observational joke about insects or something doesn't.
I opened for George Lopez once, and I kind of, like, bombed. I was, like, up here, and, like, kind of, like, didn't go great. At the time, I was living with my girlfriend. We'd watch Oprah every day together. We were, like, Oprah soldiers. So we were, like, super into it. like all about it. We're in the book club. You know what I mean? Like, we're just like full on Oprah. But the thing that always struck me as really funny is that her song at the beginning of her show is like, it was the song, it's like, run on, run on. And my joke was like, I don't think Oprah runs a lot. And and it's not a joke I would ever tell now, other than right now, into a microphone in front of a group of strangers. I go backstage and I say to George Lopez, hey, do you have any like critical feedback? And he goes, I wouldn't open with a thing about Oprah. Because they love Oprah. And they don't know who the hell you are. Because, you know, you should make fun of yourself before you make fun of other people. Because then you have a relationship with the audience. It's stuck to me to this very day.
The view glides through the venue, passing black and white tile and framed photos of famous comics.
That's my time. Thank you very much. Let's give it up for Mike Birbiglia. Woo!
Thanks, Gary. Hilarious diamonds, everybody.
I've been really grateful to be able to do these shows and, like, learn from each one.
You're killing, man. You're doing great.
Thank you.
It's exciting.
Text, the future of comedy. Hassan.
Mike Birbiglia is one of those dudes that truly loves the art form of comedy. The people that he's touched, myself, Kroll, Mulaney, we're all so different. But it is his love of comedy and his desire to help mentor.
My favorite comedians who are coming up, like Hasan Minhaj and Atsuko Akatsuka, I love that they tell personal stories, and usually, like, I love when their stories are completely different from mine.
Look what you've done!
Comedian Atsuko Okatsuka.
I had already done stand-up for maybe, like, 11 years. And my stand-up, you know, not bad, you know, but it wasn't going to be life-changing. It was definitely during the pandemic when there was just, like, a general big sadness. I turned inward. I didn't want people to feel sad.
Atsuko dances on TikTok.
I started writing more about things that was hard for me to talk about before, like my mom's mental illness.
The truth is, my mom has schizophrenia.
I never talked about it before the pandemic.
Which means she hears voices in her head and she hallucinates a lot.
And also, I started talking to my fans more and making more videos with my family because it was a mood lifter for all of us. So those dance videos that went viral and the drop challenge that went viral, that was all, you know, me running from trauma, you know? Mike found me on one of those videos.
She does the drop in an elevator.
And then he DM'd me and was like, would you want to be on my podcast?
There's a show in Vegas called The Puppetry of the Penis.
Yes, there is.
Have you seen
I've
it?
I've seen it. It's
You've seen it?
Bizarre.
After that, he asked me to open for him.
He appears in one of her TikToks.
It's just so cool, you know? He's the one that told me to get on TikTok. We don't need to talk age, but he is older than me. He's 400 years old. I'm hip. My clothes, trendy. You're telling me I need to be on TikTok. And he's like, well, I mean, do you want to be forgotten?
Atsuko, like, she started coming on the road with me and opening for me. And at one point, I said to her, like, what's the strangest thing that's happened in the last few years? And she told me
about this intruder that came to our house 3 times in the same day. I was already touring with my hour at the time. And I was like, I want to figure out a way to put this intruder story into the hour. But I don't know how.
And I was like, wow, this is great. This is a great story.
And he was like, he came to your house 3 times in the same day. That's 3 acts.
That's not just a joke. That's a whole show.
I was really excited and then, but a little scared because I was like, well, I've been doing an hour that I know works. But I want this intruder story in there. Oh, this is going to be so much more work, Mike. Okay, I'll do it.
Mike sips tea as he lays out note cards.
And then he got really excited. He loves process. He loves jokes and stories. And so he was like, okay, let's sit down. And he took out his note cards and he was like, okay, so act one is first intrusion, second intrusion, third intrusion.
In a photo, she and Mike hold up cue cards. She green screens herself over an article.
If you were to tell a younger me that as an adult I would have an HBO stand-up special, I'd be like, yeah, that sounds about right. No, I'm just kidding. I'd be like, what's HBO? We don't have cable. Earlier this year, my husband and I had an intruder come to our house. But technically, we rent, you know, yeah. So our landlord had an intruder. That's what he's so good at, having an arc in his shows.
I used to write everything down on a computer, and I actually found there was value to writing it out longhand first. When you think you have a funny idea, and you type it into a computer, it goes so fast. When you think you have a funny idea and you're writing it out longhand, about halfway through, a lot of times, you realize, oh, this stinks. And I did learn that from Mike.
It's this weird thing where I'm not just looking to him for advice, but I'm also looking for him for some form of therapy, I guess.
I'm aging into a point where I'm starting to be a mentor to people, which I don't think I ever thought I was gonna do, but sometimes that just happens. You age. And but it was helpful for me to be a student first to understand like what that is and what, as a student, what you need from a mentor. You don't want it to be pretty good. You want it to be great. And the only way you make it great is writing, failing, getting feedback.
I need more there.
Writing again, failing again.
I'll take out that line. The story peaked a little early.
Getting more feedback.
I don't know why. The ending worked well on the other show.
Is the only way that people get better.
That's what they don't teach in the after-school specials. Sometimes running away works. Right?
Eventually, if you're lucky, you'll arrive at something that is yours.
Last time was the first time I thought the getting beat up story, I think, will probably be in the next show.
This seems promising.
Thank you.
Students applaud as he leaves a screenwriting class. Mike crosses the Georgetown campus.
In some ways, stand-up comedy is like a documentary of your own life, right? In most documentaries, they shoot and they shoot and they shoot, and then eventually something happens. I go, oh, that's what it's about. It all hinges on, there has to be a main event. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the main event is of this yet.
Text, The Closer, at Hope Street Pizza.
Once every 3 weeks, our dad will call me. He'll go, Mike, the craziest thing happened. I'll go, what? He goes, I was at the hardware store and someone had heard of you. And I was like, I don't know if that's like the craziest thing.
He does say that a lot.
It's the craziest thing. Like, I think the least believable part of that story is that you were at a hardware store. Dude, the whole job is you tell jokes to strangers. Eventually, some of the strangers are going to see it.
My father did tell me once one job he would have liked would have been to be a writer for Saturday Night Live.
No.
He said that?
No.
I can't even see him saying that or watching
it. That is absurd.
Isn't that unusual?
That is so strange.
Seems out of character, right?
Right.
Joe gets the juice.
My brother Joe was talking to my dad, who's 83, who's a doctor, went to law school, never wanted me and Joe to go into comedy at all. Mm-hmm. And he said, I thought for a period of time that I could write for Saturday Night Live.
Really?
Yeah.
Was your dad funny?
My dad is very dry, and my mom is a great storyteller. Hmm.
Have you ever heard of the thing that Rilke says, how children dance to the unlived lives of their parents?
Oh.
Going to Shrewsbury this week, Dad, of course, wanted to know, who did you run into? Who did you see? And then and then you go, Mrs. Gazick, Mrs. McCown. Well, what, did they say anything about me?
They wanted to know if you were alive.
Yeah, they wanted to know if you were alive, exactly. That's, yeah. Yes, I answered that you were alive. In my 20s and 30s, as a comedian, I feel like I have so many judgments in my act of my parents. And I think as I get older, and they get older, in their 80s, I'm just like, it's like, what was I doing? When I see our childhood home, like, it definitely brings me to
Oh, yeah, like, they were just parents, just, like, trying their best.
That's right.
So it's like maybe that's what the next show is about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how literally any one of those jokes supports that idea, but it could.
The brothers sit across from each other with thoughtful expressions.
It's like the reason I don't know what the show is about is I don't know what will happen in the next 3 or 4 years.
Mike collects his cue cards.
So it's like, you know, God forbid someone close to me dies or any number of things that I'm anxious about it at all times could occur, and that I'd say most likely that's what the show ends up being about. It's just a doozy. Being an autobiographical comedian is not advisable. But also, it's my favorite type of comedy.
That's all from me. Thank you so much. Thanks for being here. I'll see you next time, everybody.
Mike walks off stage. Good One, a show about jokes. Credits roll over behind-the-scenes footage.
Still rolling? Beating?
Save it for the camera. Yeah,
save it.
What was it like?
Save it for the camera.
Okay. All right.
That's more interesting than what I have to say.
Sister Margaret walked into our classroom, and she was like, boys and girls, I'm hearing something on the playground. I'm hearing a word. And that word is fuck.
Oh, my God. Wow.
What happened to that one joke? And the reason it's gone is because of you.
You know, the thing that always impresses me the most about Mike is how much thought he puts into his clothes. When he walks out on stage, you think, oh, maybe one day I'll hit it big enough to have whoever his personal shopper is.
Pretty much everything I'm saying makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah, good job, everyone.